Namote Vasudevaya. Urva uvacha. Kati tattvani visvesha. Sankhyatani rishibhi prabho. Atta tvam iha shushum. Atta tvam iha shushuma. Shri Urva Vacha. Shri Urva said. Kati. How many? Tatvani.
Basic elements of creation.
Vishva Isha. O Lord of the universe. There's a devotee. Is he here? Vishvatmaprabhu? His name was before was Vishvesha, so it means Lord of the Universe. Vishva, like the Vishvarupa, this, you know, that's the form that the all the universal elements came out. Oh, you know, Virarupa, same thing. And Isha means the Lord. Sankhyatani have been enumerated. Rishivi. By great authorities. Prabho. O my master. Nava.
Nine.
God, the individual soul, the Mahatattva. False ego and the five gross elements. Ekadasa. Sorry. Eka kasha plus 11. The 10 knowledge acquiring and working senses, together with the mind. Pancha plus
5.
The subtle forms of the sense objects.
Trini
plus 3. The modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. Making all together 28. Yeah, making all together a total of 28.
Atta
have stated.
Tvam,
you.
Iha,
during your appearance in this world.
Shushuma,
I have heard. Okay, so that's the first verse. I'll just read the other two verses. Kejit sadving satim prahu apare panchaving satim sattaike navasat kechit chatva yeka dasha pare kechit sapta dasha prahu soda shaike trayodasha eta vat etatvatam hi sankhyanam rishayo yad vivakshaya gayanti pridak ayushman idam no vaktum ahasi. So I won't read the word for word for all that because it's quite lengthy. Translation. You want this? Buddha inquired, my dear Lord, O Master of the Universe, how many different elements of creation have been enumerated by the great sages? I have heard you personally describe a total of 28. God, the Jiva soul, the Mahatattva, false ego, the five gross elements, the 10 senses, the mind, the five subtle objects of perception, and the three modes of nature. But some authorities say that there are 26 elements, while others cite 25, or else 7, 9, 6, 4, or 11, and even others say that there are 17, 16, or 13. So it's no wonder that when you go to, you know, a place like India where they discuss, you know, Vedic knowledge and stuff, that there's so many confusing different ideas there. What did each of these sages have in mind when he calculated the creative elements in such different ways? O Supreme Eternal, kindly explain this to me. So we see here that Uddhava is actually, he's got the right approach. You know, because he's confused. There's so many different explanations that are given, you know, about the nature, or you know, what you would call Sankhya Yoga, or the description of this creation, how everything is constituted, how many elements there are, you know, how the different things are interacting. And we see in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna discusses five primary topics. He discusses Ishvara, Jiva, Prakriti, Kala, and Karma. And he gives Arjuna conclusive statements, conclusive opinions on it. Not just like another opinion. Just like we see in the Mahabharata, it points out that Nasho Rishi Yasha Matam Vibhinam, that a person is known as a Rishi when his opinion differs from another Rishi. Otherwise he's not considered to be a Rishi. But we see that the Rishis are like that. But then we see, like, we have Narada Rishi. But what's his position? He's understood to be a sthita-dhira Rishi, one who's got a steady mind. He's actually fixed. What's he fixed in? Knowledge of the Absolute, knowledge of Krishna. He's a great Vaishnava. Whereas we see these other Rishis, oftentimes you see that they're actually just trying to establish themselves as superior. And oftentimes that motivation is simply to attract followers. I was speaking in Sydney, and it just, the class caused me to sort of remember when I attended Kumbh Mela, maybe, I think it probably would have been about maybe 10 years ago, 9 years ago, what's that place called? Allahabad. And there were so many people, you've got no idea. For one day, the morning Amavasya, which was this year, it was the 11th or 12th of January, the Kumbh Mela was considered to be the biggest city in the world. There was 30 million people there. And they're all spiritual seekers. And it's quite amazing. 30 million people and no crime. Not one incident of crime. No theft, no murder, robbery, bashing, nothing. No crime at all. Because all these people there were there with the same purpose. They were there as spiritual seekers. And of course, I mean, because there's no, like, you know, gross, averse crimes like you know, as I was mentioning. But of course, there were many people there who were pretending to be things they weren't. There were many people there pretending to be spiritualists, presenting themselves as being spiritualists, without actually understanding what a spiritual seeker is, or, you know, a person who's on the spiritual path is. And there were many persons giving discourses and presenting themselves as being in knowledge. There were many persons presenting themselves as being great yogis. And actually, they were simply cheating people. Many of them. I saw one person, actually, there was a main road there between the going from one end of the camp to the other. And you could see on this road, you could see all these guys just lying down on their bed of thorns. They get all these thorn branches, because in India you get these, especially in Vrindavan, there's these trees the camels like to eat. And Prabhupada talks about in the Bhagavatam how they chew on this tree, and it's got thorns, and it pierces their tongue, cuts their tongue, and so they bleed in the mouth. They think, well, this is very tasty. I like the leaves from this tree. But actually what they're doing, because they're less intelligent, they don't understand, they can't sort of rationalize it through and see what's happening. But they think that the taste of blood is very attractive. Therefore, it's, you know, they don't understand they're bleeding. They just think the leaves are tasting nicely. And anyhow, these thorns grow in Vrindavan. And what they do is they make these beds of them. They sort of entwine them all together. They have this big pillow, like about this big and about that deep, of all these thorny branches, and they lie on that. And you know, they're all lined up. There was like 20 or 30 of them all just lined up, lying on these branches, and they've got their piece of plastic bag or whatever is in front for people to throw donations. So they're using their so-called spiritual endeavor to just attract followers to get money. I saw another person there where he had his hand up in the air like this, and he had a sword through his hand. And like, people are like, oh, you know, aghast, you know, because a lot of people who go there are just simple people. They come from the villages and things like that. They're not very sophisticated in their understanding, or in thinking that people might even be cheating like that. They just accept, well, these are great spiritualists, you know. And that's one of the reasons I was reading an article in the latest Back to Godhead, actually. I think it's the latest, yeah. No, it's the one where Prabhupada on the cover is chanting on Jaffa. And it was written by Rupa Raghunath, who previously was the head Pujari in Chol Party. He's a friend of mine. And he wrote this article about doing village preaching in Maharashtra. And one of the things they were finding is that people were very receptive. And so if they just went there and presented Krishna consciousness to them, they take it up very quickly. And it's like that, you know, when people in the country, they're less, even in Australia you find, they're less complicated, less sophisticated. They're not so affected by all the trappings of the city. And you know what it's like with the city? Constantly, all these things are being dangled in front of you. You know, on New Govardhan, you won't see any billboards. You know, there's no billboards nearby. But you just go down the street here, you know, there's billboards everywhere, there's advertising everywhere. The material energy, you know, through its agents of all these different merchants and things like that, is constantly attacking us, constantly trying to allure our senses. And what happens is after some time is we become desensitized to this, and we can, you know, oh, this person's just trying to cheat me, this person is, you know, you get exposed to all this stuff. But when people live in the country, they're less exposed to all this kind of allurement, and they don't become so desensitized because you know, they're not being harassed by these things all the time. So at Kumbh Mela also, I was seeing that the people there were easily misled by people who, and people knowing, you know, there's this mentality of the cheaters and the cheated. Prabhupada describes in one place that there's a class of men. He says there's a class of women who go to Vrindavan looking for a sadhu, because they understand that if I have a baby by a sadhu, this will be a good child, and this child will become a great transcendentalist, and they'll take me back to Godhead. They understand the philosophy, but because of lack of purity of their heart, they twist it to gain, they manipulate it to gain what they want. They want to go back to Godhead, but they don't want to do the hard yards, as they say. They don't want to do the work that's required to become purified. So they'll go to Vrindavan with the view of finding a sadhu so they can have a child, so the child will become transcendental and take them back to Godhead. And very interesting. So that's one element of the of cheating. Then there's another class of people, another class of men, who understand that women do this. So they go to Vrindavan and dress themselves as sadhus, looking for these women who are looking for sadhus to have babies by. So it's the cheaters and the cheaters. They're just ripping each other off. You know? So, you know, that's there. And so in Kumbh Mela, I saw this man. He had his arm up in the air like this, and it looked like he had a sword through his arm. And there was, it looked like blood coming down and everything like that. But I, you know, I'm an inquisitive type. I don't just accept things on face value. I remember when I was a child, you know, my father got me one of those old wind-up telephones. So I pulled the thing apart and checked out how it worked, and then I put a plug on, I plugged into the power, and rang it up and said, "Mum, there's a phone call for you." You know? And she looked at it, and she saw that it was plugged into the socket, and she realized it was live. You know, so she didn't want to touch it, and she went and got my father, you know, unplugged it all. But, you know, I'm an inquisitive type. I like to see how things work. So I went up close, and I had a look. I said, very interesting. I could see that he actually had a piece of cardboard around his arm that was painted skin color, because he had bandages above and below, right, to look like it was his arm. But I could see it was a piece of cardboard, because it just didn't have skin texture. It was all stiff and kind of rigid like that. And I could see that he got some red paint, and he painted drops of blood coming down there as well. You know, so actually, it reminds me of those things, you know, we used to get when we were kids. You know, you have like a little band you put across your head, and there's like a sword coming out either side. It's the same kind of thing. So he was just simply to get followers, simply to get money. He was presenting himself as performing some extreme tapasya. You know, because people, you know, they understand the culture. You know, that's one thing you find very prevalent in India, is the culture is still there. And Prabhupada would say, you know, the Vedic culture is just like an elephant, dead or alive, it's worth something. You know, because even when the elephant's dead, you can sell the tusks and get a lot of money. You know? Or a cow. When the cow's dead, they use the hide of the cow for making madangas, things like that. So, you know, dead or alive, it's still worth something. So, you know, largely the Vedic culture is dead, and we see that people manipulate the Vedic culture to get some gain from it. But we see that the value is there is because, you know, people still respect sadhus. People still appreciate when someone's doing austerity, that this is, you know, this personality is, you know, a person who should be respected. So, you know, people get bewildered by that because they don't have the proper discrimination. Therefore, Krishna points out, you know, you try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively, and render service to him. The self-realized soul, he can impart knowledge to you. He says, Gyananas Tattva Darshana, because he's seeing the truth, he can give you knowledge. And the same is happening here. Uddhava's confused because he's getting so much information from so many different places. I mean, you look at it, he's quoting here, like, he's saying, like, Krishna says 28, says 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 11 different accounts of how many elements there are. So obviously confusing. And but he's approaching it properly. He's approaching the supreme authority, and Krishna guides us in this way. You know, okay, maybe we can't approach Krishna directly, but we approach a person who knows. Jnananas Tattvadarshana, the self-realized soul, Tattvadarshi. You know, a person who's a Tattvadarshi, he's seeing the truth. Dashi or darshan means to see. Just like every morning at 7 o'clock, we have darshan. Yeah? So we're seeing Krishna, and also Krishna's seeing us. But a Tattvadarshi is one who's having darshan or seeing the truth, one who understands things as they are. So Krishna encourages us to take shelter of someone who's seeing the truth. Therefore, we're very blessed by having the shelter of Srila Prabhupada, because Prabhupada is clearly understanding Krishna. He's clearly seeing Krishna as he is. You know? And Krishna explains this to, in the Gita, he explains quite clearly in two verses. One in the 18th chapter, one earlier on, where he says that this is Bhakti Mama Vidyanati, that I can be understood by Bhakti. He's showing us the path. He's giving so much information in the Bhagavad Gita, how to understand clearly the process of devotional service, how to make advancement in devotional service, what is the truth, what is illusion. He says that. There's one verse, or a group of verses, I from memory, I think it's the start of the 12th chapter. Or is it the 13th chapter? I think probably the 13th chapter. Where he lists all the different important elements, and he says, apart from this, everything else is just illusion. So he's clearly delineating for us what is spiritual knowledge, what is illusion. Clearly delineating what is the path of devotional service. So Uddhava has the opportunity to have his doubts cleared up by Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we see that there's a progression here in the Bhagavatam, as we see with all these conversations. Like if you read the Acharya's commentaries on these when Krishna's speaking, they analyze very carefully the way Krishna presents the knowledge. And because Krishna is, you know, he's the most intelligent person, when he speaks words, it's not just words. There's a lot of meaning. There's a lot, you know, Krishna's, the whole thing's planned out so amazingly. Just this morning, Gopa Vrindeshwaru asked me to show him a series of prayers by Rupa Goswami called the Chitrakavatwani. So this is just to give you an idea of like how intelligent someone like Rupa Goswami is. And Rupa Goswami is a servant of Krishna. So to give you an idea of how intelligent Krishna is. In this series of prayers called the Chitrakavatwani, it starts off where Rupa Goswami is taking verses made of two consonants. He starts off with Ra and Sa. And he composes this very eloquent, beautiful prayer about Krishna. You were in Mayapur when they showed that? It was just stunning. Wasn't it? It was just so stunning that the eloquence and the beauty of these prayers. And this four-line prayer was composed of two consonants. That's all. Ra, sa. That's just amazing the way he comes out. And then it's shown, he goes into all these different things, and then he composes all these prayers of like two verses, three consonants, four consonants. Then he goes into these patterns. And you start off with I think from memory, not the first one, the second one was a wheel or a chakra. And so he starts off in the center, and there's a syllable in the center. And then halfway up the spoke, there's another syllable. Then on the rim, there's another syllable. Then you go across here, there's another syllable. Then halfway back in the spoke, there's another, same one in the middle, out again like that. And he crosses like this, and he's got this prayer that weaves its way around the pattern of a wheel, and composing a beautiful, eloquent prayer about Krishna. And then there's one in the shape of Madanga. And there's one that's a serpent. You saw the serpent one this morning. And it's so elaborate, this prayer is just going all the way around. And I asked Banaswami afterwards, I said, this is really, I mean, I was just astounded that someone could do stuff like that. And so I asked Banaswami why Rupa Goswami would do something like that. He said, just a little bit of mental exercise. It's just a little bit of mental, it's just like we, you know, we do a crossword puzzle or something like that, you know. And he's writing these amazing prayers. So Rupa Goswami's doing this as a bit of mental exercise. Gives you an idea of how intelligent he is. Yeah? And even if you look at someone like Brahma, he hears Om Bhuvah Svaha Tat Sivatur. And from that, he creates the entire material universe. Yeah? That's intelligent. You know, he hears this prayer describing that, you know, the lower planets, the middle planets, the upper planets, and the Tatsavatura, the sun. You know, he hears this prayer, and he understands, oh, this is what I have to do. And he creates the whole universe based on this one prayer. That's intelligence. That's what, you know, because we hear about like how the Brahma Samhita Sutras, but he's taken this, a sutra means something, you get this prayer, simple prayer. Om anabriti sabdat, that realization comes from sound. You take this one simple verse and unpack it into such a vast meaning. So he's taken this Brahma Gayatri or Savitra Gayatri, which is a sutra, and he's unpacked it. You know, like they talk about unpacking things these days. You know, like when they someone will give you a statement, then they unpack it, and it comes up into being quite an elaborate explanation. So Brahma was able to take this one prayer and unpack it and create the universe from that. So we can see also how intelligent he is. You know, which of us could take the Brahma Gayatri and unpack it and come up with a universe? And we chant it every day and we still don't really understand what it means. And actually I heard an interesting explanation a while ago. Prabhupada, in a class, Prabhupada was talking about the Brahma Gayatri, and he said, Tat Savatur, that is Lord Chaitanya. So everyone else is thinking this is the sun. But Prabhupada is saying it's Lord Chaitanya because he's the one who's giving us illumination. Yeah. It's quite amazing. Or I was speaking with Nityananda Priya this morning. He was saying he heard a class the other day wherein Prabhupada was talking about what's that verse? Mahatmanastin Rampata, Devim Prakritin Ashrita. You know that verse where he says the Mahatmas, they're under the shelter of my divine energy? And he's saying that the Prabhupada explained that was Radharani. Everyone else is thinking this means Yoga Maya. The Prabhupada said that's Radharani because she's the divine energy. And you see, if you look in the Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila chapter 4, and I think it was text 10 in the purport there, Prabhupada says that just as Krishna expands himself into so many Vishnu forms and so many other forms to manage the universe, Radharani also expands it because, you know, Vishnu has Lakshmi. Where does Lakshmi come from? She's an expansion of Radharani. And then the Chinmayarasa Pratibhavitabhi, she expands herself in so many forms like that. So when the Acharyas give us their commentaries and give us their understanding of these things, the meaning becomes so much deeper. We actually see so much more in it. Because why? They have this knowledge. They're actually seeing the truth as it is. It's not they have to speculate. Like, you know, we read what Prabhupada says about things. We kind of scratch our head. Or we read, you know, I was reading... I'm sure we've all read Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Maharaj's commentaries on the Brahma Samhita. You just kind of scratch your head and pull out the dictionary. He's like, what's he talking about here? Yeah? But he's so intelligent, he's able to present the knowledge in a way that's suitable for the audience he's addressing. In those days he was addressing a very, very educated audience, you know, the British, not the royalty, but the gentry, you know, the leaders of England, the lords, and the captains and all this from the armies and things. So they're educated people. So when the Acharyas, they're able to, when they present things in a way that are just suitable for us to understand. Like we see the Prabhupada, or even going back to someone like Narottam Das Thakur, he presented, you know, his songs, the songs he presented were in very simple Bengali because of the audience he was addressing. But we see that the knowledge he's presenting is very deep and very profound. He's capturing these essential points of philosophy. Same in the Brahma Samhita. It's pointed out that every single verse in the Brahma Samhita is a sutra, it's a Paribhasa sutra, and each verse contains a profound philosophical truth in one short prayer. So, you know, looking at the Acharyas and looking at Krishna's servants, we can see how elevated they are, how wise and knowledgeable they are. Then if we take this further, we look at Krishna. How intelligent is he? How knowledgeable is he? You know, he's just, you know, far superior. And so here, You know, Uddhava's got these doubts. He's not clear about all this information. So he's approaching Krishna. And by approaching Krishna, he will get the answer. He will get the right answer. And Krishna says in the Gita, he says, you know, Arjuna asking questions about things, and he says, Mata asked me, this is my opinion. He's saying, don't worry about anyone else's opinion. This is my opinion. You take it from me. This is how it is. Because he knows, because he created everything. He's the one who put the whole thing into motion. So it's just like, you know, it's an interesting story. There was a famous writer in Bengal many years ago. His name was D.L. Rai. And he wrote a book called Shah Jahan. And in this book, Shah Jahan, mostly it's talking about Aurangzeb. Mm-hmm. Was the son of Shah Jahan. So he's talking about Aurangzeb, and this, you know, Aurangzeb did this, Aurangzeb did this. So his friend's questioning him. He said, why do you call this book Shah Jahan? Because it seems to be mostly about the activities of Aurangzeb. So then D.L. Rai, he said, no, actually, I called it Shah Jahan because his book is all about the sufferings of Shah Jahan. You know, he was imprisoned by his father, his other children, his other sons were killed by Aurangzeb, his wife died at an early age, he built the Taj Mahal, etc., etc., like that. You know, so it's all, the whole book is all about the sufferings of Shah Jahan. But because his friend didn't understand the intention of the author, therefore he thought it was something else. So in the same way, Krishna understands the purpose because he's the creator. He understands why he created this universe as it is. So he's the one who knows, in fact, you know, how many, you know, and he says that to Krishna in the Gita. He says, one who understands me in truth actually will transcend this material existence. So because Krishna understands in truth how many elements there are, he understands in truth the creation of the material universe. Therefore, he is the perfect person to ask. And as it's pointed out by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in the first section of this section of the Bhagavatam, which is called Uddhava Gita, in the first section, it's discussing Karmakanda. We've seen the Vedas, there's three main divisions. There's Karmakanda, Jnanakanda, Upasanakanda. So Karmakanda means activities, you know, instructions on activities. Jnanakanda is knowledge. And this is, we see, now he's asking about knowledge of the creation. How many elements are there? Etc. like that. And then we get up to around about the 26th or the 27th chapter, you'll start asking about Upasanakanda. And that's when Krishna gives his instructions on deity worship to Uddhava. So it's a very interesting section here. Also we see, if you read the introduction, how in this section it will be described the nature of men, the nature of women. So many different things are being discussed here. It's quite an interesting chapter, actually. It discusses all the material elements. It definitively lists how many material elements are. There are the difference between female and male natures. Describes birth and death. Very similar topics to what are being discussed earlier on in the Bhagavatam. Okay, there's a purport here. I'll read that also. Lord Krishna thoroughly explained in the previous chapter that Vedic knowledge is not meant for sense gratification, but for liberation from material bondage. So you see, it's happening in this day and age that people are using Vedic knowledge for sense gratification because they can easily amass followers from that, because people think, oh, they know the Veda, therefore they must be a great personality, I'll follow them. You know, the culture is there in that I respect a superior, I respect someone who's knowledgeable in the Veda, but they don't have the discrimination required to understand whether this person really knows the Veda or not. Why? Because they themselves don't study. They don't read the Gita, they don't read the Bhagavatam, they don't study the Veda. So there's just anyone who quotes Vedic this, Vedic that, you know, oh, this is Vedic culture, or oh, this is Varnashram, oh, yes, Prabhu, I accept. Prabhupada would say sometimes, this is my one criticism of my disciples, is they don't read my books. There's no good just accepting, you know, someone sits on this green seat and starts saying, well, I know this and I know that, and present you all these truths. You know, if you yourself are not reading, because you'll accept anything. If you don't know what these books contain, you're inclined to accept anything. So we need to clearly study the books and understand what is the purpose of Vedic knowledge. Now Uddhava presents some intermediate questions that must be answered so the path of liberation will be clear. Different philosophers have historically disagreed over the exact number of material elements, about the existence and non-existence of particular external objects, and about the existence of the soul itself. The Gyanakanda section of the Vedas aims at liberation through analytical understanding of the material world and of the spirit soul as a transcendental element beyond matter. So we're seeing the elements that are being listed are the gross elements, the subtle elements, and the spiritual element, meaning the soul. And you'll see that it is there in the verse also. Ultimately, the Supreme Lord himself stands above all elements and maintains them by his personal potency. Uddhava mentions in numerical terms different methodologies of various sages, citing first the Lord's own opinion. The word ayusman, or possessing eternal form, is significant in this regard. Since Lord Krishna is eternal, he possesses all knowledge of past, present, and future, and is thus the original and supreme philosopher. And Krishna says that in the Gita. He says, Veda ham samatittani vatamani chajani bhavishyani jabutani mangdu veda nakashchana. He says, I know everything that's happening in the past. I know everything that is happening in the present. I know all things are yet to be. But me, he says, mangdu veda nakashchana. Me, nobody knows. Okay? So Krishna knows everything. There's nothing he doesn't know. But him, nobody really. You know, we may have some idea of Krishna, but can we really say we know Krishna? We know Krishna's mind. We know what Krishna's going to do. We know what Krishna's thinking. No, nobody can say that. Because he's absolute and independent. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the different analytical approaches mentioned by Sri Uddhava are actually not contradictory, since they are all different methods of categorizing the same reality. Atheistic speculation on reality does not recognize the existence of God. Consequently, it is a worthless attempt to explain the truth. The Lord himself empowers different living entities to speculate and speak on reality in different ways. The actual reality, however, is the Lord himself who will now speak to Sri Uddhava. So this is a very important point. It is being stated by the Acharyas that the actual reality is Krishna. Everything comes from him. He says that. He says, Aham savashabhava matana savam bhavatite iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhavasamabhidaha. That I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me, and the wise who perfectly understand this worship me with all their hearts. So the point being made there by the Vridhana Maharaj and the group of devotees who work on this book is that these atheistic attempts at explaining reality are useless. Because why? Because they deny the existence of God. And this is also commented on by I think it's Lord Brahma in the 11th canto, where he says, Ye ne ravindaksha vimuktamani twai yashti bhava avishudhubhariya aruya krachena param padam 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 adanti. Last line, I'm not getting. But he basically explains that he says, because of their impure intelligence, vimuktam, avishuddha buddhaya. Shuddha means pure, avishuddha means impure. And not just, it says avishuddha, so very impure. Yeah? This prefix a is the negative. It's like you say natural or unnatural, it's the same kind of thing. So you say vishuddha or avishuddha. So because it's avishuddha, it's very impure. Their intelligence is so impure. Why? Because they're not approaching the Supreme Personality of God. They're thinking that by their own endeavor to understand things, they actually see things as they are. Vimukta manina, they're thinking, vimana, the mind, they're thinking, vimukta, that I'm liberated. Just based on their knowledge, based on their impure intelligence. But actually, it says, patanti odo, yusman angraya. Patanti odo, again they go down into the material world. Again, they're pushed down to animal species of life. And we see this explained by Prabhupada later on in the Gita, how the impersonalist meditators, they're forced to take birth as animals because they're considered, and in lower species, because they're considered to be no better than demons. Why? Because they deny the existence of God. The demons want to kill God, and the Mayavadis deny God. It's the same thing. So because of this
this avishuddha buddhi, this impure intelligence, patanti ado yusmadangraya. They're forced down into lower species. They go down, ado. Why? Yusmadangraya, because they neglect the lotus feet of Krishna. Anyone who neglects Krishna's lotus feet will be forced to take lower birth. No matter what their situation is, no matter how wealthy they are, no matter how well placed they are in this world, they'll be forced to go down because of that neglect. So the only path of guaranteed success is to take shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. And that's again, as explained by Lord Brahma, I believe it was the same section, where he points out a very nice verse, where he points out how the boat of the lotus feet of the Lord, the lotus feet of the Lord are compared to a boat. Right? And if one takes shelter of the boat of the lotus feet of the Lord, then he can very easily cross over the ocean of the material world. And it's a vast, vast ocean. It's a gigantic ocean. Right? Inasmuch as a child can easily step over the hoof print of a calf. Just like you see this tiny little hoof print of a calf, and you see them, you go down to the farm, or you go to any of the farms, and you see the calves when they're walking around in the goshala, and they leave these little hoof prints. You would have seen it when you're up at Govardhan, right? They're tiny little hoof prints, and they fill up with water and urine and stuff like that. Anyone can step over them. You don't have to worry about, oh, will I get my feet wet or something, or maybe I'll drown in it or something. You don't have to worry about that. You just step over it. It's so easy. And the point that's being made there is that if we take shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna, then very easily we'll cross over. By taking shelter of Parampadam, the supreme destination, Murari, Krishna, then one will easily cross over the difficult material nature. So that's the point that's being made here at the end. And Uddhava, he's the right person because he's taking shelter, fully shelter, taking shelter of Krishna. And this is taking place just before Krishna winds up his earthly pastimes. So he's getting, you know, absolute knowledge from the Supreme Absolute Truth. So we can understand that whatever's being presented to him is the fact of how it is. Okay, so thank you very much for patient listening. Also, thank you very much for your association over the past 8 years, I think, I've been here. It's been my privilege and pleasure to be in Melbourne. My wife and I just feel it's time to move on to somewhere else, you know. And you know, she's been looking forward to moving to New Govardhan for more than 10 years, so it's been a while coming. Yeah. So it's certainly nothing personal. It's just, you know, it's time to move on to something else in life. We've done what we can do here, and you know, some new opportunities are opening up for us there. We're sick of living on a busy road, and we live on Beaconsfield Parade and all day long. It's just cars back and forwards and, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, so we're looking forward to our life together in New Govardhan. And we're also looking forward to having the opportunity to associate with and serve all of you, whether it's there or whether it's here in the future. So thank you very much. That's my life. That's what I do. I don't do anything else. Yeah, that'll go. I'll keep traveling. Keep travelling until I can't travel anymore. Any questions on the verse?
One question is sort of common in the same token. Recently we've had a change of Prime Minister, and this new Prime Minister is supposedly a very intelligent, very knowledgeable person. Yet she revealed herself this week that she's an atheist.
Mm. What if Asia is listening? Well, you know, from our perspective, then anyone who's an atheist is obviously a low-class person because they're actually denying the existence of Krishna. So whether the atheist or demon, it's the same thing. You know, atheist, demon, Mayavadi, for us, it's the same thing. And they'll be cast down. Krishna says, I repeatedly cast them into lower and lower species of life. So by her piety that she's done in previous life, she's actually got to the point of the human form of life. And she's also got to the point of being the Prime Minister of a country like Australia. How long she'll maintain that for, I can't say. But But then what happens next is, because she's denying Krishna, she'll be forced to take birth in lower species of life.
Can I make just a little comment on that? The role of the devotee is to be compassionate and merciful, even to the impersonals. And just in regards to her, when we perform by the mercy of the devotees of Rathi Yatra in the procession in Werribee, last year before, she was the guest of honour at that particular function. And I made a particular note of making sure that the devotees were very ecstatic at the time she was going to pass the dignitary. She actually stood up, she clapped, and she appreciated the cues.
Mm-hmm.
So the mercy of the devotees to actually even bring up an atheist like that, she's unaware of it.
Yeah.
But in her life, and all that she's studied, everything to do with unions and politics and everything, is not worth the fee compared to that one moment when she saw the devotees and Lord Jagannath, and she gave some respect to them. So she's saved from that downward push.
Well, there's two comments I can make on that point, if I may. One comment is that, because you talk about compassion, so in the purport to that verse where Krishna says like perpetually cast into the lower species of life, then Prabhupada says one may question, where's the compassion? So Krishna says, Prabhupada says that Krishna casts them into the lower species of life so they won't commit offences. That's his compassion, so they avoid committing offences. And as far as someone seeing the Lord on the chariot and rising up and clapping and things like that, that's a jnana sukriti. One gets pious benefit. And then, maybe in this life she won't go any further, who can say? Maybe she will. But at least in her next life, as Krishna says, Neha Bikrama Nashasti Pratyapayana Vidite Svalpamapyasidamashe Trayate Mahatobaya. In her next life she'll get a human birth because of that. Because of that one thing, she's guaranteed a human birth. Trayate mahatobaya protects her from those dangerous type of fear, which Prabhupada, again, in the purport, says this is animal birth. This is the most dangerous type of fear. Because in the animal birth, you have no opportunity for spiritual development. There's only just bestial behavior. So because of that one compassionate act by devotees, then she's assured of a human birth in the next life. Not only that, he says, Neha Bhikkhano, Svalpamapyasadamasya. That even though one may perform some small amount, in the next life, he'll get the opportunity, they will get the opportunity to take that up again. But not from the same point. If in this life you achieve the devotional service to the point of 5%, in the next life, there's interest, you start at 6%. That's the nature of Krishna. He's so merciful, he's so kind, that anyone who's done any devotional service, he wants to give them the opportunity to increase. And in a class, Prabhupada explains on this verse, he says, it's just like you want to start a business. Then, each day you're getting $1, $1, $1, $1, and eventually you have $100. Then you can start your business. So he said, in the same way, in devotional service, he quotes this, and he says that one may perform a little bit of devotional, a little bit of gyatra sukriti, they get some benefit. Then in the next life, that they do more, and it's increasing, it's constantly increasing, it's a bank balance with interest, constantly increasing. And then, Prabhupada said, you asked for me, I want to be your disciple. And so it's an ongoing thing, and even though externally, for us, if we don't know all these details, we look at it and we think, oh, this person's an atheist, and they're going to go to hell. But when we hear things like this, oh, they've actually performed some devotional services, they've seen Jagannath, they've stood up. It mentions in the Nectar Devotion, in the activities of devotional service, I can't remember if it's chapter 5 or 6, that this is one of the activities of devotional service, is that, one of these 64 items of devotional service is when the Lord passes, you stand up. So she's actually engaged in bhakti, unknowingly, which makes it a ghastly sukriti. And this can lead to bhakti. It puts one in a position where they're more responsive or more receptive to receiving devotional service. So she'll definitely get benefit from that, and she'll make progress.
First of all, thank you very much for being in the class.
Well, thank Bhakti, he let me do it.
I had a chance of going to Europe quite a few times for the Mahaprabhu mercy. And I saw in Prague what you were saying about the sword. There's a big sword, and in the marketplace, and putting right through up to the Prabhupada is telling. So that feet would you stand by nothing. But you are casting sheep on the arm.
Yeah.
So what I have seen there, and so much many people are going there. Even in Europe, not only in India. In Prague, the capital. And people were just spending money like
that. Yeah. But even that, there was one time when Prabhupada tells a story about in Calcutta, there was a man who was going to walk across the Ganges, and he was advertising, he's a great yogi, he's going to walk across the Ganges, and people were very, amazed by this. And there was a boatman there, this mystic, he was asking the boatman, aren't you going to come and see me walk across the Ganges? He said, what's the use of your 50 paisa trick? And the boatman was offended. He said, what do you mean by 50 paisa trick? He said, for 50 paisa, I'll row you across the Ganges. Well, you spend your whole life learning how to do this, I'll row you across. So these things are useless, really. Someone can swallow a sword. I mean, can they really, or is it a trick sword? They have these swords. We used to get them when we were a kid, where the blade sort of collapses, But they're, and like every year in Mayapur, they have this guy that does magic. In Mayapur, it's just a lot of it's just a trick.
Someone can produce gold or ashes.
Someone can produce gold. Someone can produce ashes. Go set fire to, you can produce a little pile of ashes. I can go set fire to a forest. How many ashes am I producing? Tons and tons of ashes. Does that make me God? Does that make me a great mystic? No, it's just some manipulation of material nature. It's all it is, in one way or another. Either it's a subtle trick or it's a gross thing, but it's just manipulation of matter. But when someone, there's actually a time, I think it was here in Australia it happened, there was a magician was doing all these tricks and pulling coins from Prabhupada's ears and stuff like that. And the devotees were getting really irate. And Prabhupada was just sitting there tolerating it. And then at one point Prabhupada said, enough. And he said, these are very interesting tricks, but I can do something you cannot do. I can save people from repeated birth and death. Can you do that? And the magician had to admit he couldn't do that. And Prabhupada said, this is the greatest thing. What you're doing is just simply a material trick. It's all this is just manipulating matter. But Prabhupada, what he could do was extraordinary.
I have one question. Why is deity worship so important for Grihastha? Just tell us somebody's
viewpoint. Deity worship is important for everybody, not just Grihasthas. He says everyone. There's a quote, you can read it in Madhyalila, chapter 15, text 108. Read it in the newer version, because the newer version's got the translation, the older version doesn't have the translation. There's an extensive quote from the Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami's Bhakti Sandarbha. And therein, Jiva Goswami points out, he says, because all those persons who are approaching us for, he doesn't say initiation, but he's indicating initiation, are so contaminated by the modes of material nature. Therefore, he starts off by saying, it is the opinion of Srimad Bhagavatam that deity worship is not necessary. Right? He says, but, however, because all those persons who are approaching us on the spiritual path are so contaminated by the modes of material nature, therefore deity worship is essential to enable them to overcome. So the thing is, Grihastha, generally speaking, in Grihastha ashram, you're very much involved in interacting with materialists and with the material energy. Therefore, in order to assist our purity and developing and maintaining purity, therefore by interacting with Krishna, he's the supreme pure. You have that interaction with the supreme pure, it helps you to maintain purity. Because without becoming pure, we cannot approach Krishna. There's a purport where Prabhupada explains that in the 13th chapter of the Gita, Adam Bhitmana Mandintam, that section there. And Prabhupada talks about purity, and he says, without purity, one cannot approach Krishna. So that's the thing, is deity worship is essential for everyone, not just, neophytes. We see Rupa Goswami, Jiva Goswami, Sanatana Goswami, Gopal Bhatta Goswami. They all had deities. Are they neophytes? These are the most, like Rupa Goswami is Rupa Manjari, an eternal associate of Krishna. He worshipped deities. Narottam Das Thakur. He worshipped shalagrams. He worshipped deities of Lord Chaitanya. You can go to Gokulananda temple in Vrindavan. You can see the deities of Narottam Das Thakur, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, Baladev Vidyabhushan. Our acharyas were writing extensive, elaborate, beautiful commentaries on the Bhagavatam. They all worshipped deities. So deity worship is essential for everyone.
Thank you.
not just new devotees. And it helps us to become purified so that we can approach Krishna. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. Grantaraj, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Melbourne Mahaprabhu Mandir Ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda Ki, Jai Nityananda Premanandi.